This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love to do, well, just about everything here, from the arts to history to love and death and marriage. And we love television, and we love commerce and capitalism and free enterprise. And no show is a better show about free enterprise and about how businesses start and how they grow on television, mainstream. I mean, it's not all perfect. It's not, you know, the guys at CNBC will be going, it's not really like that. Oh, shut up. I mean, it's just fun. It's just a TV show. And it's something like it. At least people get an idea. And in Shark Tank, a few people who were not billionaires or rich became rich. And now young people, old people alike who want to become rich and have successful businesses go to them for advice and for money. And they're pitching to the sharks. And up at Shark Tank and up in the tank this week were two guys with a chewing tobacco alternative made out of coffee called Grinds.
Hi, I'm Pat.
And I'm Matt.
And our company is Grinds. And we're here today seeking a $75,000 investment in exchange for 10% equity in our company. Our product, Grinds Coffee Pouches, are filled with freshly ground coffee that's then flavored and supplemented with B vitamins and other important nutrients to keep you bright and alert while providing a healthy alternative to chewing tobacco.
A healthy alternative to chewing tobacco. How did these two guys come up with this idea?
Matt and I met at Cal Poly. We were both business finance students playing baseball together. Matt was a catcher. He's actually drafted by the Chicago Cubs.
We're working on this econ project, and we were procrastinating, as most college students do. We ended up not having much in our pantries late night, and we needed some sort of energy kick. So what did we do? We actually took coffee grounds, regular just coffee grounds, and put it in our mouth. So after 10 minutes or so, we look at each other, we kind of smile, and we say, yeah, we kind of feel an energy kick, but we got all these coffee grounds all over our teeth.
And we just started brainstorming right away. And we said, why don't we come up with a prototype? Next thing we knew, there was a flyer on our campus that said, have a cool idea, free pizza. So being starving college students, we went down, filled out a questionnaire. Next thing you knew, we were pitching a business plan competition, had some seed money, and launched our product at spring training.
So, well, it always boils down to one word. What are the sales?
So in 2010, we did 3,500.
Matt and I were thinking at the end of the baseball season, it's time to get a 9-to-5 job. 2 days after the San Francisco Giants won the World Series, we got a call from their manager, Bruce Bochy. He said, guys, I've been using your product. It might be saving my life. I wish you guys the best.
Bingo!
We took that as the kick in the pants to say, all right, we got to make this product meet the idea. And we proceeded to find new manufacturing, raise a little bit of financing.
So basically, last year in 2011, we did 135,000. And this year, we are on track to do 300,000 by year's end.
Wow.
That's impressive. But the other important point, and by the way, that was Mark Cuban going, bingo, because he knows the power of celebrity endorsement. And particularly, I mean, does anybody chew more tobacco than Major League Baseball players and baseball players? My goodness. But the key is not only what are your sales, but Alex, of course, you know what the next one is.
Yeah, what are your margins?
What are your margins?
For retail direct to consumer, we like to offer the cans at about $3.99.
Is that equivalent to what tobacco would cost?
Tobacco can range from, on the low side, $3.50 to up to $7 with tax.
What are you going to sell it to distribution for?
$2.69 per can.
And what do you make it for?
Last year, the cost per can was $1.30. This year, it's been around $1.24, $1.25, and we're hoping to drop it at least below $1.10 by the end of the year.
Not bad. Barbara Corcoran. I don't suspect she chews much tobacco, in or out.
I love your energy. I think you have great energy. I can't imagine you not selling this product, frankly. I get it, but it's just not a product I can relate to, chewing something in my mouth like this, so I'm out.
No, doesn't work in Manhattan. Mr. Wonderful, in or out.
Coffee companies have a lot of coffee. If you prove out this category, why wouldn't they crush you like the cockroaches you are right now? What you need is capital. You need money to fire it up, and you got to get into retail faster. You don't want to wait until the coffee guys figure it out and come after you. You want to get the brand out in every store you possibly can. You need money. Why don't I provide you with $100,000? And the way you pay me back is every time you sell a tin, you give me a quarter. I'm going to make it easy. I'm not going to ask for any equity at all. Maybe I'm your guy. I'm your bank.
Perhaps, yeah.
Perhaps, yeah. Mr. Wonderful loves to just do that sort of almost, it's almost like licensing. And that's where he made his money, and that's what he does. Robert and Damon, a tag team deal?
I'll give you the $75,000 for 15%, but
I really would like Damon to deal with me, not because I need the money, but I think he can do the distribution. I mean, that's his specialty.
I'm okay with Robert on that because this is such a good deal and you guys know your stuff.
So what exactly are you offering here?
So 75,000, 37.5 from each of us for 15%.
So there are two deals on the table, but everyone always wants to know if Cuban wants in.
Look, guys, in any sport, you can play small or you can go big. I see tobacco replacement products as a medium-sized industry. I see you guys carving out a nice niche, but like I always say, you know, the most valuable asset I need to get a return on is my time, and the return on time just isn't there. So for that reason, I'll make it easier for these guys, and I'll go out.
And that's generally Cuban's feeling. And again, we learn about all kinds of things in this game, that there's capital, money, there's capital that's knowledge, and then there's time, and money is time. So we got Mr. Wonderful, and we got Robert and Damon. Do we have a deal?
It's equity versus a royalty. What are you going to do?
Damon and Robert, we've accepted your deal. Yeah. Damon,
Robert. Go. Home run.
Thanks, guys. Great. Hey, we're excited. Wow. Looking forward to working with you guys.
All right, great job.
And another good segment here. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And if you want to watch Shark Tank, it's on ABC on Friday nights, and it's running in an almost continuous loop in the evenings on CNBC. And also, check out The Prophet. And we're trying to get the star of The Prophet on this show. Marcus is just a terrific talent. And watching him fix a family business, watching him make it work, and watching him, in the end, not just make it profitable, but bring the family back together is generally the problem with small family businesses often is battles and emotional battles between members of the family. And this is Our American Stories again. This is Lee Habib. And catch all of this at OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and joining us, as always, for our weekly sports roundup and our weekly sports segment is Nate Scott, and he's with USA Today, and they're for the win section, and that's ftw.usatoday.com, and it's a terrific website, and we love going there because it's just so pithy, and it's so much fun, and Nate, thanks for joining us.
Of course, happy to be here.
You bet. And Nate, we don't always bump in on this segment with Billy Idol or White Wedding, but you did something unusual that we have to talk about before we go on with the sports segment. You did something that, well, fewer and fewer people are doing now, Nate. They're taking the plunge and they're getting engaged. You went away to get engaged. Where did you go to and what happened?
I grew up in the great state of Maine, actually, so I went home to Maine and surprised my girlfriend, brought her family up for the weekend. She didn't know they were coming, and then proposed right there, and then we had a week trip to Canada. I took the slowest sports week of the year, and I used it in my favor, and I got out of town and enjoyed it, so... we're doing this thing.
You're doing this thing. Excellent. So in other words, she said yes.
She did say yes. That happened, yes.
You know, the thing is, when you're doing this thing called an engagement, you can think you've got it in the bag. You can think it all day long. But until she says yes back, you don't. And you never know what could happen. Did you have any nerves at all, Nate, about popping the question, or were you pretty sure of yourself?
I was great until about 10 minutes before, and then I melted down, and I think she realized. She said, "What's going on?" I said, "Nothing." And she said, "You're freaking out." And I said, "Well, here we go."
Well, Nate, what you might want to do is once a week, we speak with a lady, Deb Wolniak, who's one of the great marriage coaches, not a counselor, a coach. And when people go into her program, the divorce rate just plummets because she believes that when people wait too long to the crisis— Sometimes the marriage is irreparable. And if you have a coach the whole way through, especially during the happy times, when the tougher times come, you actually have ways to deal with it. So, you know, if you ever get a chance, you got a spare hour, listen to Deb. She's terrific. I do all the time. I've been married 12 years, and I still can't get enough of it. Congratulations, Nate. Just great and happy news.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Let's talk hoops. And you guys have really been nailing the fun sports stories lately. Let's take a run at a few. Jason Williams, Charles Barkley, and McDonald's. What's the story here, Nate?
Yeah, so Jason Williams was appearing on a podcast last week and was telling stories about his early days in the league. And he shared the story of Charles Barkley's, what he said was Charles Barkley's practice regimen, which was, while the rest of the team was practicing, Charles Barkley would show up with a large bag of McDonald's breakfast food, combine all the foods into one massive, disgusting sandwich, and then sit on a stationary bike going 1 mile an hour, eating this unholy concoction that he had put together.
Why is that not hard for us to believe?
And the best part is, though, you know, you hear these apocryphal stories. They never get confirmed. They asked Charles Barkley, and he said, oh, yeah, that used to happen. He didn't fight it at all. That's what I used to do.
That's too much. And what did the others do? Did any of the others have the guts to emulate this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think this. He might have been the last generation. He said, you know, when I was growing up, that's what Dr. J used to do. That's what Moses Malone used to do, so I did it. I think the NBA has changed since then. I don't think you're going to hear about LeBron James sitting on an exercise bike eating McDonald's.
No, I don't think so. And something tells me Kobe Bryant never did that, and Michael Jordan never did that. That's just a guess, Nate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, speaking of guys having a little fun in the NBA, tell us about Yao Ming, the NBA star who came here from China. And by the way, what a life story. I'm almost begging ESPN to do that 30-30.
It's really unbelievable. I mean, one of the most interesting stories, and I still think in this country, we don't properly appreciate, A, how great Yao Ming was, and B, how important he was in spreading this game globally. I think, you know, other than Michael Jordan and maybe LeBron James, Yao Ming is responsible for growing the NBA more than any one man. But he tells a fantastic story he wrote in the Players Tribune this week, but his first year in the league, and he showed up as Yao Ming, and in China, the surname goes first. So growing up, he was known as Ming to everyone. His last name was his family name was Yao. And on the first day of practice, no one knew that at the Rockets, so everyone just called him Yao. And because he was so shy and so scared about being in the NBA, he never corrected anyone, and that just became his name. Because on the first day of practice,
that's
he was
great.
Too shy. A 7-foot-6 guy is too shy to correct anyone.
And tell
so that's
me
how he became Yao.
What's his status in his home country, and what happened to the NBA viewership as a result of that? Did people have access to the NBA up until then? Did the NBA ever go to China and play? I'm a big fan, but I don't know that have we taken the game there in person. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean it really has, and he's done a lot of work growing the game there. Camps he'll do, thousands of kids will show up, and you know they. China has a professional league now. I know Stephon Marbury's playing there, and he's a major star in China. You know, it's sort of their version of Michael Jordan, which he did kind of all after his career in the NBA. And I know Jeremy Lin's jerseys are now, you know, every year one of the highest-selling jerseys in the world, just because that country right now is and continues to be mad about the NBA. And it's why, you know, investors are excited about the NBA, not just for its growth in the United States, but for its growth around the world.
You know, Nate, the reason I always loved basketball, my dad was a really great ball player and trained up two sons to be all-county and all-state players in New Jersey. And what was great about it is my dad would take me to Newark, drop me off at a court, and say, good luck, kid. These are the boys you're going to have to play against in the state finals. Have some fun. I'm going to go eat. And all you need is a ball and two guys, and you got one-on-one. Six guys, and you got three-on-three. 10 guys, you got a full court game. And you can just play, and it's a lot like soccer in this respect. It's just really cheap to play.
It's cheap to play. You don't need much. You don't need a lot of people, and it's why, you know, the NFL, it will always be America's game, I think. But if you're thinking on a global scale, the only sport that will ever come close, I think, to challenging soccer on a global level will be basketball, and it's for that very reason.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, baseball's difficult too. I mean, you really need a full. If you don't have a center fielder and a left fielder, every time there's a hit, it's easy to get a hit without a full team. Yep. So stuff.
Yep.
Let's talk about top 10 celebrity sports fans, because you guys decided to rank them. And there are some pretty interesting characters here. And one of them, by the way, I've heard may not be as big a fan, or is maybe just sort of laying back. Is Jack Nicholson still at it, or is he retiring from fandom? What's the story with Jack?
I think Jack is, hanging on. It would be hard-pressed to stay with this Lakers team through this slump they're currently on. You know, Spike Lee, who was our number one fan on our list, his Knicks fandom is tied in with losing. It's about suffering. That's part of the identity there.
It's
Jack
so
and the Lakers, all he's ever known is winning.
I know.
For his entire life as a Lakers fan. So now these last few years must be tough. And he's getting up there in years, but I think he'll stick around.
I think he will, too. These rumors are greatly exaggerated. He's looking for one more ring, and he's a little bit spoiled. You're right about, by the way, Spike, but for the Pat Riley years, he wasn't even old enough to hit the Knicks back in the early 70s. So he knows maybe two or three decent runs in all those years sitting at that front court seat. Let's talk about Bill Murray. Talk about his fandom.
Bill Murray is a part owner of the Charleston River Dogs minor league baseball team, which is sort of an underreported thing. And he goes to all the games. He's sitting there. He sits in the owner's box. He screams nonsense at the opposing team. And he's sort of a fixture there in and around Charleston. And you'll hear stories of people going to a game and eating a hot dog and Bill Murray coming up and checking to make sure that their hot dog tastes good, because he's an owner of the team and wants to make sure everyone's having a good time.
That's great.
I mean, why not? If you're Bill Murray, why not own the Charleston River Dogs?
Why not? Why not? And what about Usher and Justin Timberlake, two people from the music business?
Yeah, they also got in on that Cavaliers ownership team, which is why Usher was in the team photo when the Cleveland Cavaliers were celebrating. He was down on the court in the team photo. A lot of people were confused. They thought he'd become part of LeBron's entourage or something. But no, he's a part owner of the Cavaliers.
Yep.
I think he's getting a ring.
I think he is. If you're a part owner, you do. And Justin Timberlake, of course, is a Memphis boy, and we don't broadcast far from Memphis. And is he as big a Grizzlies fan as I can imagine?
I think so. I think he's big with that team. He's all about Tennessee.
Well, we love having you on, Nate. And congratulations! And let us know when the wedding is. And and let's get a sub for that day or two. And though there's no substituting for you, Nate, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, guys.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that's Nate Scott on our weekly segment. And that's For the Win, FDW.USAtoday.com. We love the site. You should, too. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and we love great stories about music, sports, love, death, business, American history. And our favorite subject is generosity and the generous things Americans do for each other and do for the world. And we love that space of gratitude, too, because in the end, when you have gratitude, happiness is possible. And if we can do anything with this show, that's one of the things we want to try and do here. It's just give people a little bit of light in their day, each day. And it's why we love bringing you our sweet charity segment with our partners, the Philanthropy Roundtable, the nation's leader in fostering excellence in generosity, protecting philanthropic freedom, and assisting givers in achieving their goals. And the host of the series is none other than Carl Zinsmeister, their head of publications, and a guy as eclectic as the stories you'll hear in this great series. Carl has authored 11 books, including two from his on-the-ground reporting during the Iraq War. He has a storytelling cookbook and even a graphic novel published by Marvel Comics. A graphic novel from a guy who is an aide to Daniel Patrick Moynihan and served as the chief domestic policy advisor to the President of the United States. He also lives in a houseboat, which more than anything should tell you that you're in for a treat. Take it away, Carl.
Charismatic animals. We all have our favorites. Grizzlies and bison, dolphins and manta rays, big swooping owls and sparkly hummingbirds, a moose dripping on the edge of a lake. They set our pulses racing if we're lucky enough to glimpse them in the wild. During my latest trip to Yellowstone Park last winter, one of the creatures I spent many hypnotic minutes observing from the snowy riverbanks were the trumpeter swans. These are the largest birds in America, with 7-foot wingspans, thick bodies wrapped in brilliant white plumage, and huge black bills, which they use like shovels to scuffle up eelgrass and algae and duckweed, reaching below the river's surface with their long, muscular necks. Like other swans, trumpeters move with beautiful tuxedoed grace, but because of their great bulk, they require a watery runway the length of a football field in order to take off into the air. They come to Yellowstone in the winter because the hot geyser runoff pouring into some of the streams there prevents the water from freezing, even amidst the fierce high-altitude cold. A generation ago, you had to be very lucky to stumble upon a trumpeter swan patrolling some river. But today, the majestic animals are making a comeback in the U.S., and Terry Kohler is one of the reasons why. The Wisconsin industrialist and his wife Mary are both bird lovers. They are both pilots, and they are both local patriots. So when they were asked to help reintroduce the endangered trumpeter swan to its former Wisconsin habitat, they quickly agreed. Their first task was to fly their company's business jet to Alaska to pick up a clutch of eggs that biologists had removed from the nests of some of the remaining wild trumpeters. These were whisked off to the Milwaukee County Zoo for a captive breeding program. The Kohlers donated their time and airplane every spring for many years. They also gave money to the biologists, and Terry designed and had built special incubators that could protect the precious eggs and keep them at the perfect temperature even while they were in transport 30,000 feet in the air. This project eventually allowed trumpeter swans to be reintroduced to their historic Midwestern flyway. After being absent for a century, there are now more than 5,000 of these huge native birds migrating up and down the center of our country every year. Not long after their first trip to ferry trumpeter eggs, the Kohlers were asked to undertake a similar but even harder mission. The nonprofit International Crane Foundation asked if they would fly precious whooping crane eggs to the continental U.S. from a different part of Alaska for a similar captive breeding program. The Kohlers became crucial financial patrons and problem solvers for the effort, in addition to serving as volunteer pilots. Whooping cranes are one of the rarest species in the world. During the 1940s, the entire population dwindled to only about 20 birds. Today, there are several hundred. If you see one, you are not likely to forget it. They are sparkling white with brilliant red faces and have a long dagger-like beak. They are the tallest bird in America and could look eye to eye with most humans. Like humans, they dance in spectacular ways during mating season. And there is a reason they are called whoopers. The first step in bringing those haunting cries back to U.S. fields and marshes was to build up a population of captive adults who could breed new generations. After that was accomplished by the Kohlers flying eggs down from the far north, a painstaking program was created to teach the hatchlings born each year how to forage, how to settle themselves safely at night, and how to fly. Human trainers wore white robes, covered their faces and hands, and used puppets that looked like mother cranes to guide the young birds. The next step was a long one. After a migratory bird like a whooping crane has flown south to its wintering grounds just once, it will remember how to get back and forth the rest of its life. But every bird needs to be shown how to do it the first time. There were no migrating adults on the eastern flyways to teach the young captive-raised whoopers. So, Terry Kohler and other volunteers and donors proposed a radical idea. An ultralight airplane, essentially a hang glider with a small motor, flown by a pilot costumed to hide his human traits, would be used to lead the birds down to Florida. From 2001 to 2015, new birds were trained to identify with the tiny plane and then led south in short daily bursts of flight all the way to their wintering grounds. In the spring, these birds returned to Wisconsin on their own to nest. Today, there are about 100 whooping cranes in the eastern migratory population. This accomplishment was not cheap. It cost about $100,000 per bird to reestablish these cranes. But if they can continue as a permanent and growing group, they will be an invaluable addition to the 300 wild whoopers that migrate the western flyway between Canada and Louisiana. At first, only a few of the introduced eastern birds showed the instinct to mate and make nests. That was eventually overcome. The number of birds laying eggs rose from just a handful in the beginning to dozens every year now. And more of the eggs they lay have been hatching. Last year, 24 chicks began life in Wisconsin nests made by the released birds. The next big challenge for biologists and their charitable backers is to improve the whooping crane's parenting behaviors. Currently, only a few of each year's hatchlings survive to fly south by the end of the summer. To strengthen the bird's instincts for rearing their young, training by costumed humans is being phased out. From now on, chicks born in captivity to be added to the eastern flock will be paired with adult cranes, and human contact will be minimized. In addition, the 15-year program to lead new migrators south with ultralight planes has been ended, since there are now adult birds that have already made the trip and are capable of leading new arrivals. This difficult, ambitious, and exciting work has been accomplished by a string of donor-funded groups like the International Crane Foundation and the nonprofit known as Operation Migration, cooperating intensively with each other and with state wildlife organizations. As a result, the trumpeter swan is safely back from the brink of extinction. The whooping crane has made great progress in the same direction. And if you're lucky, someday at dusk, you may see a breathtakingly grand bird stretch its wings, throw back its lanky neck, and let out a primal noise that declares that America still has a wonderfully wild streak. And for that, you can thank some dedicated scientists, plus Terry Kohler and a group of very patient donors.
Great job on that, Carl. And just a bit more about Terry Kohler, because, you know, when he suffered from a divorce, he decided to start a nonprofit to at least try and figure out how to stop other divorces. And that nonprofit was Great Marriages of Sheboygan County, and they've done a miracle of work and great work and all kinds in that county, reducing the divorce rate in their county. And that's how we came to know Deb Walniak, who's our marriage coach in our Marriage on the Mind segment. This is Lee Habib. Sweet charity, generosity, a fundamental part of the American story on Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us, as always, by Hillsdale College. And on this day in history, the movie Caddyshack was released in 1980. The movie was inspired by writer and co-star Brian Doyle Murray's memories working as a caddy at Indian Hill Club in Winnetka, Illinois. Brian's brothers Bill and John Murray and director Harold Ramis also had worked as caddies when they were teenagers, and many of the characters in the film were based on characters they'd encountered at the club. Let's listen to director and writer Harold Ramis describe how Caddyshack started out as a movie about the caddies, but quickly became about something else.
Well, we set out to do a movie about the caddies and what it was like to be a caddy on a suburban golf course.
There have been a lot of complaints already. Fooling around on the course, bad language, smoking grass, poor caddying. You want to be replaced by golf carts, just keep it up.
And in the casting process, we hired such high-powered adult talent, Rodney Dangerfield and Ted Knight and Chevy Chase and Bill Murray, that inevitably all our creative attention went to making those characters work, and the caddy story kind of didn't fade into the background so much as the story of the main caddy really got interlaced.
Titans of comedy littered this cast, and Harold Ramis here explains how improvisation became a staple in the making of this cult classic.
In comedy, there's this intangible that that you have to like strive for and achieve every day, and there are no rules for it. We always trusted improvisation. We never felt like we were just ad-libbing or winging it. It's an actual technique and a method that allows you to create material instantly. And it's not just, you know, grabbed out of thin air. You actually plan what you're going to do, and you have it's like having a script without finished dialogue.
But put this in the hands of somebody like Bill Murray, and oh my goodness. In this completely improvised scene, Murray is swinging at perfectly manicured flowers as he imagines himself at golf's pinnacle tournament, the Masters.
What an incredible Cinderella story. This unknown comes out of nowhere to lead the pack at Augusta. He's on his final hole. He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think. Well, he got all of that. The crowd is standing on his feet here at Augusta. The normally reserved Augusta crowd going wild for this young Cinderella who's come out of nowhere. He's got about 350 yards left. He's going to hit about a 5-iron, I expect, don't you think? He's got a beautiful backswing. He got all of that one. He's got to be pleased with that. The crowd is just on his feet here. He's a Cinderella boy. Tears in his eyes, I guess, as he lines up this last shot. He's got about 195 yards left, and looks like he's got about an 8-iron. This crowd has gone deadly silent. Cinderella story, out of nowhere. A former greenskeeper now about to become the Masters champion. It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole!
Hey, young fella. I was hoping to squeeze in 9 holes before this rain starts.
Certainly, Your Eminency.
Take my bag, huh?
Certainly, Your Magnificence.
Okay, come on. Chop, chop. Let's go.
And, well, again, leave it in the hands of Bill Murray and you get something brilliant. Try this with someone else and you have mush, more than likely. By the way, we learned that the gopher was actually created by the folks over at the studios that created Star Wars. So they were taking seriously what that gopher looked like. We also, of course, encounter the great Rodney Dangerfield. And his comedic genius was starting to sweat on set.
I'll never forget the first day Rodney came to work. All the comics were there to watch this guy work because he was the best, right? Rodney gets up, he sees all the comics, and he gets that performer's energy up, and he's delivering his lines. And then after a couple of takes, he starts to sweat, and he's upset, and, you know, I'm trying to figure what the hell's wrong, you know? So I go, Rodney, what's the matter? He goes, hey, nobody's laughing at me. I'm bombing out there. And I said, Rodney, they can't laugh at you. He says, that's right, because I'm no good. I suck. And he says, no. He says, all those guys out there, all those comics. I said, Rodney, you don't understand. They can't laugh because if they laugh, they can't use the soundtrack. So it's contrary. He thought that he was bombing and all these other comics are there because he was the best.
And he wasn't, is the best. And well, let's take a listen. You be the judge as to what type of job Rodney Dangerfield did.
Hey, orange balls. I'll have a box of those. Give me a box of those naked lady tees and give me 2 of those. Give me 6 of those. Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw. Well, you buy a hat like this, I'll bet you get a free bowl of soup, huh? Oh, it looks good on you, though.
And you may not know that the famous Baby Ruth pool scene was based on a real life incident at writer and actor Brian Doyle Murray's high school. Let's take a listen.
Want some?
Oh, give me some.
Who asked you?
Come on, I'm asking.
I didn't Joey, ask would you. Please? Get out Joey, of here. Would... Hey, thanks a lot.
Don't touch it.
Yeah, well, if you find anything that doesn't look like a fecal remnant.
I want the entire pool scrubbed, sterilized, and disinfected. Here it is. It's no big deal.
The following is producer John Peters, director Harold Ramis, and Chevy Chase describing how the two biggest stars in the movie did not appear together in any scene.
In the middle of the movie, we realized there was no scene between Billy and Chevy. And I went to Mark, who was my partner, and I said, you know what, the two biggest stars in the movie aren't in the movie together.
We knew we needed a scene with me and Billy because we'd been shooting a long time and we just didn't have one. And
I took the actors off and I think we just sat and had lunch and started talking about, you know, Carl growing grass that you could actually play on and smoke at the same time. So
we had lunch. It was Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis and Billy and me. And this is to my best recollection. And we wrote that scene during lunch and shot it in the afternoon.
Chevy would be practicing the night before for God knows what reason. And we would see where Carl lives. It's like, all right, now we're going to see these two guys together. Fine. You know, it had nothing to do with the plot. It was just those two guys being funny.
What I love is Billy. I love him to death.
And it's interesting because Chevy and Bill were not great friends, and they'd had a run-in on Saturday Night Live, and it was kind of interesting getting them together and watching them actually work well together.
Take two, Mark.
Action!
You son of a bitch. Where are you? Oh, hi, Carl. Sorry to bother you.
Hello, Ty.
How are you? Pretty good. Can I play through? Do you mind?
Sure, yeah. It's getting kind of a late nine, is that it?
Yeah, well, greens are pretty busy in the daytime.
What, missing a ball here?
Yeah. Is this your place?
Yeah, what do you think?
Oh, it's really awful, Carl. It's awful.
Well, I've got some stuff on order. It hasn't come in yet. I'm waiting. Awaiting credit approval still. They say assistant greenskeeper means nothing.
Oh, don't listen to that stuff. You see my ball anywhere?
Try list?
That's it.
Yeah, that's you there.
Can I get a ruling on that?
Well, I should probably get a free drop over the shoulder, no closer to the hole.
Okay. Well, okay, you go ahead.
And there you have it, folks. On this day in history, the movie Caddyshack was released in 1980. And this was Harold Ramis' first time directing, by the way. Had a budget of mere $6 million. It grossed 40, which back in those days got you into the top 20. It would be the equivalent of about $115 million in today's money. And Bill Murray was on the set for only 6 days of the 11-week shoot and steals the movie. Let's go out listening to Bill Murray in his Kill the Gophers scene. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
I want you to kill every gopher on the course.
Check me if I'm wrong, Sandy, but if I kill all the golfers,
They're gonna lock me up and throw away the key.
Gophers! The great kid, not golfers! The little brown furry rodents!
We can do that.
Fine!
We don't even have to have a reason.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We talk to all kinds of people on this show, and today we bring you our interview with TV's Chris Hansen. And you know Chris from Dateline NBC's To Catch a Predator. And my goodness, that show, it was shocking to parents, and my goodness, what great work Chris did and does. And more recently, on Killer Instinct, on Investigation Discovery. Killer Instinct begins its second season on ID Monday night at 9 Eastern Standard Time. Chris Hansen talked with our own Jesse Edwards about what to expect in their new season and about how he got into investigative journalism at just 14 years of age. Here's Jesse.
8-time Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist Chris Hansen of Investigation Discovery's popular series Killer Instinct, now in season 2. Chris is also the creator of To Catch a Predator. He's received several awards for excellence in journalism, including the Edward R. Murrow Award. Investigation Discovery's popular Killer Instinct with Chris Hansen returns for a second season with America's most chilling and heart-wrenching homicide cases. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Jesse.
What can we look forward to here in this new season, season 2 of Killer Instinct?
Well, what ID has allowed me to do is to go out and cover these stories and do the interviews the way I like to do them, very comprehensive, detailed. And then they combine, you know, the work I do in the field with some incredibly compelling cinematic recreations. And each one of these episodes ends up looking like, you know, a mini motion picture. It's really, really good stuff.
Some people, for a lack of a better term, call it murder porn. Investigation Discovery viewers coined the term ID addicts. You recently attended a true crime convention, kind of equivalent to a Comic-Con, where these people get together and they talk about these things. What is it about these forensic crime shows that has people so into these stories?
Well, I think it's because we take them into a place they would not normally see. We show them things they wouldn't normally see. We say things they wouldn't normally hear. And when you get so deep into a case like this, it's fascinating. And we try to take the viewer on a journey of discovery. And I think by getting into the people's minds, whether it's a killer or a detective or the family member of a victim, we can better prevent people from becoming victims themselves. I mean, you talk about the ID con. We weren't sure how many people were going to show up in New York. They limited to 400. There were 7,000 people on the waiting list.
Wow. It's incredible.
We'll do it in a theater next time. And people really relate to these stories. And I take that responsibility seriously.
Do you find that it's more male or female predominant audience that really gets into this stuff?
ID in the coveted demographic, which is the female audience. We are the number one network in America. We hover between number one and number two, but I think as of right now, we're number one. And it speaks to the quality of the storytelling and the production and the kinds of stories we pick.
You get in such great depth with these gruesome stories. Does it ever get to you? Does it ever bother you? Do you ever get just, or are you just kind of callous to the fact, or does it get under your skin?
I'm never callous to it. You know, it's interesting because last year when we premiered season one, I was at the Television Critics Association conference in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills, and a fellow who works for, you know, one of the syndications who's covered me for, you know, 30-some years asked me that very same question. He said, "Do you ever go to therapy or see a counselor for this stuff?" I said, "I don't want to explore this down there. It's too dark. It's deep. It's all capped off. It's fine." But you can never lose your sensitivity. You know, and you have to handle these interviews in the appropriate manner. But yeah, I mean, I'm able to sleep at night. I mean, obviously, I've seen many dark things and talked to many people about, you know, gruesome crimes, and I've been doing this for 34, 35 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to compartmentalize a little bit, but you still cannot lose your sensitivity.
You've got 8 Emmy Awards and some Edward R. Murrow Awards. What inspired you to get into journalism in the first place?
When I was about 14, I lived in suburban Detroit, about a mile and a half from where Jimmy Hoffa was kidnapped. And I was fascinated by it. I used to ride my bike, you know, to the restaurant where he was last seen and look at the crime scene and all the FBI agents and local police and reporters and correspondents. And I just kind of got bit by the bug, you know, right then and there. So when I went off to college, I, you know, went to the campus radio station and signed up and became a newsman at 18 years old.
What do you think happened to Jimmy Hoffa?
You know, I've chased that story for forever, and obviously, based upon, you know, my discussions with law enforcement sources, I think he was either, you know, in Detroit or a garbage disposal type situation in just outside of Detroit and ground up. I don't think there's any left.
A lot of people, including myself, know you originally, of course, from To Catch a Predator. Do you think child predators in this country get in enough trouble, or do you think they're just kind of sent through a revolving door often just to go out and offend again?
I think mostly justice is served. I think, you know, in our investigations, the initial ones on Dateline, you know, some 300 guys surfaced, and the penalties range from probation and registration as a sex offender to, you know, 24 years in prison. In the latest investigation, Hansen versus Predator, which we're sorting out in the next few weeks where that's going to air, we did this few months ago. We had 11 guys show up and already 8 of them have pleaded guilty. And the, you know, sentences range from probation to, you know, 5 years in prison. So I think the judicial system does a pretty good job with this. And each guy is different. So, I mean, some guys can get probation at a young age and not do it again. They're scared. Some guys need probation, punishment, and treatment. And there's a third group that are just hardcore pedophiles, and that's probably their only thing. And the only choice is to lock them up.
Did you ever run into, like, a lot of legal trouble trying to go after some of these scumbags on that show?
No, because, you know, one, you know, we're very careful with our methodology. And we, obviously, law enforcement and you know, the prosecutor's office are involved. You know, they know the proper way to go after these guys. And two, you know, we're completely transparent about our methodology. So, you know, if you want to say that it's not traditional journalism, that's fine. That's fair. I'm open to have that discussion. But this was a situation where, in order to infiltrate a very serious crime, we had to use enterprising techniques. And the first two that we did originally, law enforcement was not involved. And it was socially irresponsible not to have law enforcement involved. And it was ultimately, from a television standpoint, unsatisfying to the viewer.
And there you have it. Thank you, Chris Hansen. And Killer Instinct begins its second season on Investigation Discovery, Monday nights at 9 Eastern Standard Time. This is Our American Story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And regularly, we like to talk to Lenora Skenazy, who's the author of a book and blog, Free Range Kids, and a contributor to Reason.com. And her TV show, World's Worst Mom, airs on the Discovery Life channel. And we're fortunate that the head of this movement, and we hope that Free Range Kids is and will become an even bigger movement, the freerangekids.com is where, by the way, you can find Lenore. And Lenore describes the movement as, quote, fighting the belief that our children are in constant danger from creeps, kidnapping, germs, grades, flashers, frustration, failure, baby snatchers, bugs, bullies, men, sleepovers, and or the perils of a non-organic grape. And I just love that. Thanks for being here, Lenore.
Oh, what a pleasure, Lee. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. What we want to do is regularly just drill down with a single story. And just so people know how Lenora got the term, the world's worst mom, she allowed her 9-year-old to ride the subway alone. And this created mayhem in the New York media. And that's why she's doing what she's doing now, the reaction to the reaction. Talk about this story about this 11-year-old Florida kid who was simply playing in his yard.
Yeah, this is last year. This 11-year-old came home from school, and normally his mother is there, or if she's not, his dad is there. The mom is a teacher. She's 20 minutes away. At the most, he has a couple minutes waiting for her to come home. And actually, this is a mom who is so extremely protective of her child that for kind of a weird reason, she never gave him a key to the house because she was worried that if, this is what she told me, that if burglars entered the house and he was there alone, he would have very little chance of getting out alive, whereas if he was outside, he was never going to be trapped in the home with the burglars. All right, so she's already thinking ahead to how can she keep her son very safe. Maybe she's not making the same decision you or I would make, but it's clearly a mom who cares about her kid.
Yep.
But anyways, on this particular day, he gets home, and she is stuck in traffic, and her husband, who would normally be home quickly because he works nearby, was also on a call and couldn't get there. And so for 90 minutes, we're talking 1 hour and a half, and a boy who's 11 plays in his backyard. He picks up his basketball, you know, he shoots some hoops. Somebody sees him there, realizes, oh my goodness, that's a boy. He is not going inside. There's nobody home. He's by himself. Calls the cops. The cops come to the house. They find the boy there, and then they wait for the parents, okay? Because clearly this is a boy who has been neglected, and neglect and abuse are sort of fused in their mind. And so when the parents finally get back, which is the hour and a half, they got there, they throw the parents into the cop car. They take them and the son over to the police station. They fingerprint the parents. They take their picture. They strip search them. They throw them in jail. And because now the parents are in jail, the boy must go with his younger brother, who was elsewhere at the time, into foster care because there is nobody at home because the cops are so worried about the children being neglected that they put both their parents in jail, right? So now they are neglected, and the kids go off, and guess what? The kids are in foster care for a month, because what the cops said in this case is that this was a poor 11-year-old child who was kept behind a home with no food, no drinks, no shelter, and no bathroom. And somehow, having to survive 90 minutes without any of these, and actually there were plenty of those because they had a hose and they had a shed, so they had food and they had water and shelter. They just didn't have a bathroom. Oh, boy. Somehow that constituted such an imposition, such a grave danger that the parents were criminals.
And who makes that decision in the end? I mean, in the end, legally, Lenore, is there sort of a some strict ordinance, or are there rules?
You know, I wish I could tell you this. It's such a mishmash because there are two different, courts going on at once. One is criminal court. You know, is this a crime? And the crime generally is leaving a child in danger. You're not allowed to leave a child in danger, and different states have different ages for what age you are generally allowed to leave a kid alone. In Maryland, it's 8, and in Illinois, it's a bizarre 14 years old. But the point is that you're allowed to leave them unless they're in danger, and that becomes a question of, well, who determines what's dangerous? To me, a kid in his own yard might be in danger of being bored, you know, might be in danger of being hot. It was in Florida. But in danger of what else? Nothing that, to my mind, rises to the real definition of danger, which is putting him in, you know, danger of life or limb. I mean, there's just no danger there. And, in fact, if he felt bad, if he needed help, he's a sentient human being. He can knock on a neighbor's door if he felt like he was, you know, desperately needed a bathroom or was going to faint from hunger. I mean, you know, we're not talking about leaving a worm in the backyard. We're talking about leaving a person. But then there's the parallel justice system of Child Protective Services. And in a way, it's more scary with them because they don't have to have a regular jury trial to determine if somebody is guilty or not. If somebody from Child Protective Services says, this was a real danger, judge, and we have to make sure that the child is safe, I think the judge can just listen to that. I wish I knew more about exactly how the systems work, and sometimes they overlap. But I can tell you that they are both allowed to interfere with normal, everyday parenting decisions, and they seem to be doing it in a way that I don't recall either Child Protective Services or the cops doing when I was a kid when my mom let me play outside.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, we would have all been locked up in my generation.
Mm-hmm.
We went out. I mean, we were free-range kids, and everybody was a free-range kid
in the
early 70s. No, it's so true. And Cindy and Fred, who are the names of the parents here, I wanted to just read something from you because you got and heard about the case from Cindy, and this was the email, and this was her explanation to you. The authorities claim he had no access to water or shelter. We have an open shed in the backyard and two working sinks and two hoses. They said he had no food. He ate his snacks already. He had no bathroom, but the responding officer found our yard good enough for him to relieve himself while our son sat in a police car alone.
Yeah, pretty gross.
I know, it's truly gross.
Yeah.
Now, in his own yard in a state, Florida, that has no minimum age for children to be alone. I think it's this protective services space, Lenora, that's so scary to people. Because in the end, the presumption of innocence and guilt, you know, at least in the criminal law, we're innocent until proven guilty. There's a grand jury trial. There's a warrant. There's probable cause. There are all these things to protect actual criminals. It's in our Constitution. But once you get to the administrative state, we're guilty until we can prove that we're innocent. Everything shifts.
Right. That's why one of the things I'm trying to do lately is to get towns, cities, states, eventually the federal government to pass what I call the Free Range Kids Bill of Rights, which maybe I've talked to you before about, which shifts everything back to the way I think it should be, which is this presumption of innocence. So the Free Range Kids Bill of Rights is simple. It's one sentence long. It says, children have the right to some unsupervised time, and we have the right to give it to them without getting arrested. The problem in this situation seems to be that simply because the kid was unsupervised, suddenly he's considered in danger, even though there's no evidence of actual danger. And if he is in danger, that means that the parents are negligent, because why would they put their child in danger? So we have to stop criminalizing the idea that any time a child is unsupervised, automatically parents are bad and the child is in danger. And so if we simply started from what you're talking about, which is the, you know, innocent until proven guilty, it's like, let's assume that parents think that kids can handle themselves walking to school, playing in the yard, waiting in the car for a couple minutes while they run in to get the pizza. Let's assume that our job as onlookers and then even as police and as Child Protective Service workers is to help the family. If we think the kid is in danger, we ask, are you okay, kid? Yes, I'm fine. We don't automatically assume that, oh, yay, it's like a Pokemon. Look, I caught one.
Right.
This one is unsupervised. That means that the parents are bad. That means that automatically I get to throw them in jail and take away their kids. That's not the kind of town I want to live in. I want to live in a town where if the police see my child and they're worried about him, they help him as opposed to immediately throwing me in jail, which is not helping anybody and also is bizarre. I mean, it's based on this assumption that simply by walking along the street or playing in my yard, I am in danger as a child. That's not true. And even in terms of crime is down. We're at a 50-year crime low now. So if your parents let you play outside, ride your bike to the library, there's no reason that you should think that today's kids are more in danger. They're less in danger.
That is so true. And again, we're talking with Lenora Scanese, Free Range Kids, and she's an author. And, well, Free Range Kids is what we love talking about, and we're going to continue to. She's also a contributor to Reason.com, and her TV show, World's Worst Mom, airs on the Discovery Life channel. Lenora, thanks as always for joining us. You bet. And this is Lee Habib, Free Range Kids. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and here on this show, we tell stories of dignity, struggle, love, art, you name it. And every now and then, we find one that practically has it all. Can you imagine being locked up for 22 years in prison, all because you refused to put a sign with three words on it? Well, that's exactly what happened to Armando Valladares in Fidel Castro's Cuba. Armando later wrote of his incarceration, quote, "For me, it meant 8,000 days of hunger, of systematic beatings, of hard labor, of solitary confinement and solitude, 8,000 days of struggling to prove that I was a human being, 8,000 days of proving that my spirit could triumph over exhaustion and pain, 8,000 days of testing my religious convictions, my faith, of fighting the hate my atheist jailers were trying to instill in me with each bayonet thrust, fighting so that hate would not flourish in my heart, 8,000 days of struggling so that I could not become like them." Well, he didn't become like his torturers. No, instead, Armando became a poet, an artist, a diplomat, a human rights activist, a loving husband, father, and grandfather. For living such a hard life so well, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty honored Armando Valladares with their 2016 Canterbury Medal. We're now joined by the Beckett Fund's executive director, Christina Arriaga, to talk more about this amazing man. Christina, before we get deeper into Armando's story, tell us a little bit about the Beckett Fund, and in particular, this thing you call the Canterbury Medal. What is distinguishable about Canterbury?
Sure, and thank you for having me on.
You bet.
The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty is a public interest law firm that defends the free expression of all religious traditions. So we are a law firm that takes all of our cases pro bono. In other words, we don't charge our clients. And we believe religious liberty is a vital human right. It is the ability for human beings around the world to search for the truth. And wherever that path takes them, whether it's organized religion or no religion at all, the government has no role in that path. The government should not intrude in that path. We believe that religious liberty is not the eccentric uncle of the human rights family, or that it should not be treated like secondhand smoke, like it often does in the United States. We think it's vital to be able to live according to one's deeply held convictions.
You know, and it's interesting, the ACLU, I think, does a laudable job of trying to keep people from religion. That is, theocracy is something we don't subscribe to on the show. And at the same time, there's the free exercise clause of our great Constitution. And those two are always in conflict. I think they were from the beginning, and they were designed to be that way, don't you think?
Yes, our founding fathers drafted the First Amendment in such a way that it would always be a balance between making sure that in this country we never established a religion, but also that every American would be able to conduct themselves according to their beliefs, not only at home or at church or at the synagogue or at their temple, but also in the way they live their lives. So you're right to say that it's always a balancing test to make sure that the government is not endorsing religion, but at the same time, the government is not intruding in the lives of people that want to wish according to their deeply held convictions.
Yeah, and that it gets right to conscience, I think, in the end, and to the right of the Christian, the Jew, the Muslim, or the atheist to just live unfettered from government intervention.
That's right, yes.
And tell me a little bit about the significance of Canterbury as well, before we dig into this remarkable story.
Sure. The Beckett Fund was named Beckett after Thomas of Becket, the saint who was martyred because he refused to allow the king to interfere in the church's business in England. We have the Canterbury Medal after Canterbury Cathedral, where Thomas of Becket was martyred. And we give this medal once a year to a person who has refused to render to Caesar what is not Caesar's. And we've been giving this award for the last 20 years. The first recipient was the great Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel, who passed away this year. And the recipient last year was, as you stated, the Cuban poet Armando Valladares.
And we just, by the way, did an hour on Elie Wiesel. And if you want to hear it, folks, go to ouramericannetwork.org. He passed recently, but on our show, every year on the day of his death, we will replay that hour because it was that kind of life and that kind of testimony to the human spirit and the human heart and the dignity of living free. One other thing, by the way, if you ever want to see a great movie, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton version of Beckett, get it on Netflix. It's just terrific. You cannot get a better movie. Let's talk a little bit about this man and tell us about his background and the Cuba he knew when he was young.
Armando Valladares was a 23-year-old poet and artist. And like many poets and artists, he kept a day job as well. And during the day, he worked as a postal worker in Cuba. He was a government employee. And this is during the time of the revolution. This is 1959 to 1961, where Fidel Castro has taken over the government. He has executed thousands of former government officials. He is now arresting men and boys and executing them and having mass graves. And he started to send his people to different government offices and was requiring that government workers put a sign on their desk that said, "If Fidel is communist, sign me up," or "I am with Fidel." So a government official, a military government official, comes to Valladares' desk and says, "We'll put up the sign," and Valladares says, "No," not ever imagining the consequences that action or how he would suffer because of his refusing to sign up to the communist ideology.
And in the end, it's artists and poets and the like who play such an important life, Christina, in the life of a nation, because they're the storytellers. And if you can own the storytellers, well, you've got it. And so this is one of the cosmic fights in any regime that wants to control the thought and the conscience of man. It's the front, the big front is the artist's front, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we see this in history. In the former Czech Republic, Václav Havel, the great defender of freedom, was an artist himself and a writer. Valladares often speaks publicly about Viktor Frankl's book about the Holocaust, and he many times Holocaust survivors attributed their being able to survive to the storyteller that was with them, or to the violinist who was able to play music once in a while. It's what makes us human, right? It's art and culture and the storytelling. And all of these regimes, whether it's a Nazi or the communist or the fascist and Pinochet regime in Chile, what they try to do is strip us away from our humanity. And if we can hold on to that humanity and that human dignity, we're often able to endure things that we thought would be unimaginable.
And Viktor Frankl's book, In Search of Meaning, is right up there with Elie Wiesel's masterpiece, Night, in terms of great literature that spawned from the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust itself. And that's the thing about art. It can shine even in the most degrading and most terrifying circumstance. When we come back, Christina Arriaga, the Beckett Fund, more about this amazing life story, Armando Valladares, the Cuban poet, diplomat, and human rights activist, who, as you'll hear in the coming segment, just lived through, well, not hell, but as close as we can come to hell on earth, and all for one simple reason. He would not write or say, "I'm with Fidel." This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Armando Valladares, the Cuban poet, diplomat, human rights activist. This story came across my desk in several forms. People from every walk of the political aisle in life sent me the link to the Wall Street Journal excerpt of the speech you're about to hear in a minute or two that Mr. Valladares gave at the Beckett Fund after being awarded the Canterbury Award and the Canterbury Medal, which is something that the Beckett Fund gives away each year to people who fight for freedom of conscience and religious conscience. And Armando, my goodness, the story you're about to hear. Joining us is Christina Arriaga from the Beckett Fund. And Christina, let's talk about life in prison for Armando, because he could have at any moment gotten out. He had to get out of jail free card. And that was simple. Say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I'm with Fidel. That's it. He's out. Talk about that.
That's right. Armando Valladares was immediately subjected to a number of degrading tortures. He was also stripped naked and put into solitary confinement for 8 years. And during those 8 years, he was subject to the guards throwing buckets of urine and excrement on him. When he left solitary confinement and the punishment cells, he was unable to walk. He was covered in fungus. He had almost lost his sight because he had not been exposed to the sun. And during this entire time, he was told many, many times, all you have to do is sign a piece of paper that says, I am with Fidel, and you will be released. And he said years later in his book, and when he has traveled around the world, he has said many times that for him, that would have been spiritual suicide. And he could have never done that. He would have emerged with a body that was alive, but a spirit that was dead. And he also said, and I find this so remarkable, that all those years that he was alone in solitary confinement, he was never really alone because God was in the corner of every corner of his cell. That's astounding to me. He was also, he would not wear the common prisoner uniform because he said he was a political prisoner, and he went on 17 different hunger strikes, the last of which lasted 46 days.
Well, he was a man who wanted to do this on his terms, and he knew that despite the fact that he was in jail, there was a spiritual struggle going on here. That's what this was. This wasn't actually a physical fight. It was a spiritual fight, and they couldn't take away from him the one thing they wanted in the end, and that had to be his sustenance, I suspect.
Oh, absolutely. He defied the regime in every single way that he could, including sneaking little pieces of paper and writing whenever he got a pencil or a pen or any sort of ink, writing poetry. In fact, he wrote 12 copies of this first book of poetry, which he then handed to the woman who would become his wife. And she left Cuba and was able to publish the book in France. As you can imagine, the Cubans were not happy that this had been smuggled out, so he was subjected to even more torture and more pressure. But the book caught on fire, and he won the Pen Award, which is a very prestigious European award, and his wife was able to tell the world what was going on in Castro's prisons. At the time that Valladares was in prison, there were over 15,000 political prisoners in Cuba, and the world knew nothing about them. So it was through Valladares' courage and defiance and his wife being able to travel the world, highlighting their plight, that a lot of people came to know about political prisoners in Cuba. At one point, he was sent to another punishment cell where he was again stripped naked, and he had no access to paper or anything else. So he was able to get a minuscule piece of paper that was taken out of a medicine bottle, and because he didn't have ink, he started to write with his own blood. He would pierce his finger and find a little piece of wood, and he would write with his own blood.
You know, there's a remarkable movie that's now in rotation in television, as much as Shawshank Redemption and The Godfather. And again, it came across the TV, and I couldn't stop watching it. And you have to see it. I don't know if you've seen it, Christina, but it's Denzel Washington and Gary Oldman in the Book of Eli. And Denzel Washington has the last Bible, and it's post-apocalyptic America or the world. And he's got to get it to some place, and he doesn't know where. And it's just a remarkable story, very much like Armando's, about conscience, about following God, and letting nothing stand between it. And by the way, life would have been much easier for this man, the character that Denzel Washington plays, if he'd simply given up the last copy of the Bible to Gary Oldman, the villain in the piece. And by the way, as you had said about the 15,000 prisoners, there are so many young people in America today who have no idea about Cuba's past. And if you'd watch a Michael Moore movie or any of the propaganda being peddled by the far left on Cuba, this part of Cuba's history, and its present, by the way, is largely avoided. And talk about that for a second before we play this clip that we have, Christina.
Sadly, there are still more Valladares left in Cuba. And in fact, just last week, I met with one of them. There is a Afro-Cuban medical doctor. His name is Oscar Elias Bisset, who has been in prison several times simply for asking the government to respect human rights. He has been inspired by Martin Luther King and by Gandhi. He's a peaceful man. He has been subjected to so much torture that both his arms and have been broken, his wrists have been broken, and he's lost most of his teeth. He was given a 2011, he was told he could leave prison as long as he agreed to leave the island of Cuba, and he refused. And he stayed in prison for a longer term. He has just been given a visa to travel to the U.S. He's here temporarily, and he is going back to Cuba to fight for freedom. They're heroes in Cuba, and there's still as much repression in Cuba as there was in the 50s and the 60s.
You bet. And now let's take a listen, Christina, to the speech that Armando Valladares, again, the Cuban poet, diplomat, and human rights activist, gave for the Beckett Fund, and the excerpt of which was in the Wall Street Journal and brought you to our table. And by the way, you do the translation here. Let's take a listen.
For many of you, particularly for you young people, it may seem that I come from a faraway land from a long, long time ago.
Amigos jóvenes, puede que nunca sufran la experiencia de ser llevados a punta de pistola como me ocurrió a mí por mantenerme fiel a mi conciencia.
Young friends, you may never be taken away at gunpoint, as I was, for staying true to your conscience.
Pero hay muchas maneras de verse silenciado en sus escuelas, en sus universidades, en sus centros de trabajo.
But there are many other ways to take you away and to imprison your body and your mind. There are many ways you can be silenced in your schools, your universities, your workplace.
Les advierto que igual que existe una pequeña distancia entre Estados Unidos y Cuba, hay una distancia muy pequeña entre la democracia y una dictadura donde el gobierno decide lo que creemos y lo que hacemos.
I warn you, just as there's a very short distance between the United States and Cuba, there's a very short distance between a democracy and a dictatorship where the government tells you what you do, what do you think, and how to live.
Y a veces la libertad no es arrebatada a punta de pistola, sino mediante un pedazo de papel cada vez. Una ley aparentemente insignificante cada vez, un silenciamiento cada vez.
And sometimes your freedom is not taken away at gunpoint, but instead it is done one piece of paper at a time, one seemingly meaningless rule at a time, one small silencing at a time.
Tengan cuidado, amigos jóvenes. Nunca cedan. Nunca permitan que el gobierno o cualquier otra persona o entidad les diga lo que pueden o no pueden creer, lo que pueden o no pueden decir, o lo que sea que sus propias conciencias les ordenen hacer.
Never allow the government or anyone else to tell you what you can and cannot believe, what you can and cannot say, or what your conscience is telling you to do or not to do.
Un país que no es perfecto, pero que nos permite vivir en una sociedad donde cada cual puede tener una opinión diferente a la de otra persona y a la del gobierno.
Our country is not perfect, but nevertheless, it still allows us to live in a society where we can hold a different view from each other and a different view from the government.
Algo que no solamente se tolera en una democracia, sino que se define como un derecho que debe protegerse por la ley.
This is not something that is merely tolerated in our society, but instead is a right that is protected by our own laws.
And there you have it. I mean, I'm just so moved. Christina, I want to thank you for doing all you do at the Beckett Fund. Christina Arriaga is the executive director there. And you were listening to Armando Valladares' speech and his acceptance of the Canterbury Award Medal. And Valladares, a Cuban poet, diplomat, human rights activist. These are the kind of stories we tell here at Our American Stories. And Christina, thanks so much for doing all you do.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch this. This will be posted on the web tomorrow morning. And share it with your friends. And share it with all freedom-loving people. More after these messages.